anything that Jesus said or did. The words attributed to Jesus were written decades after his death, and the Christian Bible, like the Hebrew one, is riddled with contradictions, uncorroborated histories, and obvious fabrications. But just as the Hebrew Bible offers a glimpse into the values of the middle of the first millennium BCE, the Christian Bible tells us much about the first 2 centuries CE. Indeed, in that era, the story of Jesus was by no means unique. A number of pagan myths told of a savior who was sired by a god, born of a virgin at the winter solstice, surrounded by 12 zodiacal principles, sacrificed as a scapegoat at the spring equinox, sent into the underworld, resurrected amid much rejoicing, and symbolically eaten by his followers to gain salvation and immortality. The backdrop of the story of Jesus is the Roman Empire, the latest in a succession of conquerors of Judah. Though the first centuries of Christianity took place during the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, the alleged peacefulness has to be understood in relative terms. It was a time of ruthless imperial expansion, including the conquest of Britain and the deportation of the Jewish population of Judah following the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. The preeminent symbol of the empire was the Colosseum, visited today by millions of tourists and emblazoned on pizza boxes all over the world. In this stadium, Super Bowl-sized audiences consumed spectacles of mass cruelty. Naked women were tied to stakes and raped or torn apart by animals. Armies of captives massacred each other in mock battles. Slaves carried out literal enactments of mythological tales of mutilation and death. For example, a man playing Prometheus would be chained to a rock, and a trained eagle would pull out his liver. Gladiators fought each other to the death. Our thumbs up and thumbs down gestures may have come from the signals flashed by the crowd to a victorious gladiator telling him whether to administer the coup de grace to his opponent. About 500,000 people died these agonizing deaths to provide Roman citizens with their bread and circuses. The grandeur that was Rome casts our violent entertainment in a different light, to say nothing of our extreme sports and sudden death overtime. The most famous means of Roman death, of course, was crucifixion, the source of the word excruciating. Anyone who has ever looked up at the front of a church must have given at least a moment's thought to the unspeakable agony of being nailed to a cross. Those with a strong stomach can supplement their imagination by reading a forensic investigation of the death of Jesus Christ based on archaeological and historical sources, which was published in 1986 in the Journal of the American Medical Association. A Roman execution began with a scourging of the naked prisoner. Using a short whip made of braided leather embedded with sharpened stones, Roman soldiers would flog the man's back, buttocks, and legs. According to the JAMA authors, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. The prisoner's arms would then be tied around a 100-pound crossbar, and he would be forced to carry it to a site where a post was embedded in the ground. The man would be thrown onto his shredded back and nailed through the wrists to the crossbar. Contrary to the familiar depictions, the flesh of the palms cannot support the weight of a man. The victim was hoisted onto the post and his feet were nailed to it, usually without a supporting block. The man's rib cage was distended by the weight of his body pulling on his arms, making it difficult to exhale unless he pulled his arms or pushed his legs against the nails. Death from asphyxiation and loss of blood would come after an ordeal ranging from 3 or 4 hours to 3 or 4 days. The executioners could prolong the torture by resting the man's weight on a seat or hasten death by breaking his legs with a club. Though I like to think that nothing human is foreign to me, I find it impossible to put myself in the minds of the ancients who devised this orgy of sadism. Even if I had custody of Hitler and could mete out the dessert of my choice, it would not occur to me to inflict a torture like that on him. I could not avoid wincing in sympathy, would not want to become the kind of person who could indulge in such cruelty, and could see no point in adding to the world's reservoir of suffering without a commensurate benefit. Even the practical goal of deterring future despots, I would reason, is better served by maximizing the expectation that they will be brought to justice than by maximizing the gruesomeness of the penalty. Yet in the foreign country we call the past, crucifixion was a common punishment. It was invented by the Persians, carried back to Europe by Alexander the Great, and widely used in Mediterranean empires. Jesus, who was convicted of minor rabble-rousing, was crucified along with two common thieves. The outrage that the story was meant to arouse was not that petty crimes were punishable by crucifixion, but that Jesus was treated like a petty criminal. The crucifixion of Jesus, of course, was never treated lightly. The cross became the symbol of a movement that spread through the ancient world, was adopted by the Roman Empire, and 2 millennia later remains the world's most recognizable symbol. The dreadful death it calls to mind must have made it an especially potent meme. But let's step outside our familiarity with Christianity and ponder the mindset that tried to make sense of the crucifixion. By today's sensibilities, it's more than a little macabre that a great moral movement would adopt as its symbol a graphic representation of a revolting means of torture and execution. Imagine that the logo of a Holocaust museum was a shower nozzle, or that survivors of the Rwandan genocide formed a religion around the symbol of a machete. More to the point, what was the lesson that the first Christians drew from the crucifixion? Today, such a barbarity might galvanize people into opposing brutal regimes or demanding that such torture never again be inflicted on a living creature. But those weren't the lessons the early Christians drew at all. No, the execution of Jesus is the good news, a necessary step in the most wonderful episode in history. In allowing the crucifixion to take place, God did the world an incalculable favor. Though infinitely powerful, compassionate, and wise, he could think of no other way to reprieve humanity from punishment for its sins, in particular for the sin of being descended from a couple who had disobeyed him, than to allow an innocent man, his son no less, to be impaled through the limbs and slowly suffocate in agony. By acknowledging that this sadistic murder was a gift of divine mercy, people could earn eternal life. And if they failed to see the logic in all this, their flesh would be seared by fire for all eternity. According to this way of thinking, death by torture is not an unthinkable horror. It has a bright side. It is a route to salvation, a part of the divine plan. Like Jesus, the early Christian saints found a place next to God by being tortured to death in ingenious ways. For more than a millennium, Christian martyrologies described these torments with pornographic relish. Here are just a few saints whose names, if not their causes of death, are widely known. Saint Peter, an apostle of Jesus and the first pope, was crucified upside down. Saint Andrew, the patron saint of Scotland, met his end on an X-shaped cross, the source of the diagonal stripes on the Union Jack. St. Lawrence was roasted alive on a gridiron, a detail unknown to most Canadians, who recognize his name from the river, the Gulf, and one of Montreal's two major boulevards. The other one commemorates St. Catherine, who was broken on the wheel, a punishment in which the executioner tied the victim to a wagon wheel, smashed his or her limbs with a sledgehammer, braided the shattered but living body through the spokes, and hoisted it onto a pole for birds to peck while the victim slowly died of hemorrhage and shock. Catherine's wheel, studded with spikes, adorns the shield of the eponymous college at Oxford. St. Barbara, namesake of the beautiful California city, was hung upside down by her ankles while soldiers ripped her body with iron claws, amputated her breasts, burned the wounds with hot irons, and beat her head with spiked clubs. And then there's St. George, the patron saint of England, Palestine, the Republic of Georgia, the Crusades, and the Boy Scouts. Because God kept resuscitating him, George got to be tortured to death many times. He was seated astride a sharp blade with weights on his legs, roasted on a fire, pierced through the feet, crushed by a spiked wheel, had 60 nails hammered into his head, had the fat rendered out of his back with candles, and then was sawn in half. The voyeurism in the martyrologies was employed not to evoke outrage against torture, but to inspire reverence for the bravery of the martyrs. As in the story of Jesus, torture was an excellent thing. The saints welcomed their torments because suffering in this life would be rewarded with bliss in the next one. The Christian poet Prudentius wrote of one of the martyrs, "The mother was present, gazing on all the preparations for her dear one's death, and showed no signs of grief, rejoicing, rather, each time the pan hissing hot above the olive wood roasted and scorched her child." St. Lawrence would become the patron saint of comedians because while he was lying on the gridiron, he said to his tormentors, "This side's done, turn me over and have a bite." The torturers were straight men, bit players. When they were put in a bad light, it was because they were torturing our heroes, not because they used torture in the first place. The early Christians also extolled torture as just deserts for the sinful. Most people have heard of the seven deadly sins, standardized by Pope Gregory I in 590 CE. Fewer people know about the punishment in hell that was reserved for those who commit them. Pride, broken on the wheel. Envy, put in freezing water. Gluttony, force-fed rats, toads, and snakes. Lust, smothered in fire and brimstone. Anger, dismembered alive. Greed, put in cauldrons of boiling oil. Sloth, thrown in snake pits. The duration of these sentences, of course, was infinite. By sanctifying cruelty, early Christianity set a precedent for more than a millennium of systematic torture in Christian Europe. If you understand the expressions to burn at the stake, to hold his feet to the fire, to break a butterfly on the wheel, to be racked with pain, to be drawn and quartered, to disembowel, to flay, to press, the thumbscrew, the garrote, a slow burn, and the Iron Maiden, a hollow hinged statue lined with nails, later taken as the name of a heavy metal rock band, you are familiar with a fraction of the ways that heretics were brutalized during the Middle Ages and early modern period. During the Spanish Inquisition, church officials concluded that the conversions of thousands of former Jews didn't take. To compel the conversos to confess their hidden apostasy, the inquisitors tied their arms behind their backs, hoisted them by their wrists, and dropped them in a series of violent jerks, rupturing their tendons and pulling their arms out of their sockets. Many others were burned alive, a fate that also befell Michael Servetus for questioning the Trinity, Giordano Bruno for believing, among other things, that the earth went around the sun, and William Tyndale for translating the Bible into English. Galileo, perhaps the most famous victim of the Inquisition, got off easy. He was only shown the instruments of torture, in particular the rack, and was given the opportunity to recant for having held and believed that the sun is the center of the world and immovable, and that the earth is not the center and moves. Today the rack shows up in cartoons featuring elasticized limbs and bad puns. Stretching exercises. Is this a wind-up? No pain, no gain. But at the same time, it was no laughing matter. The Scottish travel writer William Lithgow, a contemporary of Galileo's, described what it was like to be racked by the Inquisition. As the levers bent forward, the main force of my knees against the two planks burst asunder the sinews of my hams, and the lids of my knees were crushed. My eyes began to startle, my mouth to foam and froth, and my teeth to chatter like the doubling of a drummer's sticks. My lips were shivering, my groans were vehement, and blood sprang from my arms, broken sinews, hands, and knees. Being loosed from these pinnacles of pain, I was handfast, set on the floor, with this incessant imploration, "Confess! Confess!" Though many Protestants were victims of these tortures, when they got the upper hand, they enthusiastically inflicted them on others, including 100,000 women they burned at the stake for witchcraft between the 15th and 18th centuries. As so often happens in the history of atrocity, later centuries would treat these horrors in light-hearted ways. In popular culture today, witches are not the victims of torture and execution, but mischievous cartoon characters or sassy enchantresses like Broomhilda, Witch Hazel, Glinda, Samantha, and the Halliwell sisters in Charmed. Institutionalized torture in Christendom was not just an unthinking habit. It had a moral rationale. If you really believe that failing to accept Jesus as one Savior is a ticket to fiery damnation, then torturing a person until he acknowledges this truth is doing him the biggest favor of his life. Better a few hours now than an eternity later. And silencing a person before he can corrupt others or making an example of him to deter the rest is a responsible public health measure. St. Augustine brought the point home with a pair of analogies. A good father prevents his son from picking up a venomous snake, and a good gardener cuts off a rotten branch to save the rest of the tree. The method of choice had been specified by Jesus himself. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. Once again, the point of this discussion is not to accuse Christians of endorsing torture and persecution. Of course, most devout Christians today are thoroughly tolerant and humane people. Even those who thunder from televised pulpits do not call for burning heretics alive or hoisting Jews on the strapado. The question is why they don't, given that their beliefs imply that it would serve the greater good. The answer is that people in the West today compartmentalize their religious ideology. When they affirm their faith in houses of worship, they profess beliefs that have barely changed in 2,000 years. But when it comes to their actions, they respect modern norms of nonviolence and toleration, a benevolent hypocrisy for which we should all be grateful. Medieval Knights. If the word saintly deserves a second look, so does the word chivalrous. The legends of knights and ladies in King Arthur's time have provided Western culture with some of its most romantic images. Lancelot and Guinevere are the archetypes of romantic love. Sir Galahad, the embodiment of gallantry. Camelot, the name of King Arthur's court, was used as the title of a Broadway musical. And when word got out after John F. Kennedy's assassination that he had enjoyed the soundtrack, it became a nostalgic term for his administration. Kennedy's favorite lines reportedly were, "Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot." As a matter of fact, the knightly way of life was forgot, which is a good thing for the image of the knightly way of life. The actual content of the tales of medieval chivalry, which were set in the 6th century and written between the 11th and the 13th, was not the stuff of a typical Broadway musical. The medievalist Richard Cowper tallied the number of acts of extreme violence in the most famous of these romances, the 13th century Lancelot, and on average found one every 4 pages. Limiting ourselves to quantifiable instances, at least 8 skulls are split, some to the eyes, some to the teeth, some to the chin. 8 unhorsed men are deliberately crushed by the huge hooves of the victor's war horse, so that they faint in agony repeatedly. 5 decapitations take place. 2 entire shoulders are hewn away. 3 hands are cut off. 3 arms are severed at various lengths. 1 knight is thrown into a blazing fire, and 2 knights are catapulted to sudden death. 1 woman is painfully bound in iron bands by a knight. 1 is kept for years in a tub of boiling water by God. 1 is narrowly missed by a hurled lance. Women are frequently abducted, and we hear at one point of 40 rapes. Beyond these readily enumerable acts, there are reports of three private wars, with, in one case, 100 casualties on one side, and with 500 deaths with poison in another. In one tournament, to provide the flavor, Lancelot kills the first man he encounters with his lance and then, sword drawn, struck to the right and the left, killing horses and knights all at the same time, cutting feet and hands, heads and arms, shoulders and thighs, striking down those above him whenever he met them, and leaving a sorrowful wake behind him, so that the whole earth was bathed in blood wherever he passed. How did the knights ever earn their reputation for being gentlemen? According to Lancelot, Lancelot had the custom of never killing a knight who begged for mercy, unless he had sworn beforehand to do so, or unless he could not avoid it. As for their vaunted treatment of the ladies, one knight woos a princess by pledging to rape the most beautiful woman he can find on her behalf. His rival promises to send her the heads of the knights he defeats in tournaments. Knights do protect ladies, but only to keep them from being abducted by other knights. According to Lancelot, the customs of the kingdom of Logres are such that if a lady or a maiden travels by herself, she fears no one. But if she travels in the company of a knight and another knight can win her in battle, the winner can take a lady or maiden in any way he desires without incurring shame or blame. Presumably, that is not what most people today mean by the word chivalry. Early modern Europe. In Chapter 3, we will see that medieval Europe settles down a bit when the knightly warlords are brought under the control of monarchs in centralized kingdoms. But the kings and queens were hardly paragons of nobility themselves. Commonwealth school children are often taught one of the key events in British history with the help of a mnemonic. King Henry VIII to 6 wives he was wedded. 1 died, 1 survived, 2 divorced, 2 beheaded. Beheaded! In 1536, Henry had his first wife, Anne Boleyn, decapitated on trumped-up charges of adultery and treason because she gave him a son that did not survive, and he had become attached to one of her ladies-in-waiting. 2 wives later, he suspected Catherine Howard of adultery, and sent her to the axe as well. Tourists visiting the Tower of London can see the chopping block for themselves. Henry was clearly the jealous type. He also had an old boyfriend of Catherine's, drawn and quartered, which is to say, hanged by the neck, taken down while still alive, disemboweled, castrated, decapitated, and cut into 4. The throne passed to Henry's son Edward, then to Henry's daughter, Mary, and then to another daughter, Elizabeth. Bloody Mary did not get her nickname by putting tomato juice in her vodka, but by having 300 religious dissenters burned at the stake. And both sisters kept up the family tradition for how to resolve domestic squabbles. Mary imprisoned Elizabeth and presided over the execution of their cousin, Lady Jane Grey, and Elizabeth executed another cousin, Mary Queen of Scots. Elizabeth also had 123 priests drawn and quartered, and had other enemies tortured with bone-crushing manacles, another attraction on display in the Tower. Today the British royal family is excoriated for shortcomings ranging from rudeness to infidelity. You'd think people would give them credit for not having had a single relative decapitated, nor a single rival drawn and quartered. Despite signing off on all that torture, Elizabeth is among England's most revered monarchs. Her reign has been called a golden age in which the arts flourished, especially the theater. It's hardly news that Shakespeare's tragedies depict a lot of violence, but his fictional worlds contained levels of barbarity that can shock even the inured audiences of popular entertainment today. Henry V, one of Shakespeare's heroes, issues the following ultimatum of surrender to a French village during the Hundred Years' War. "Why, in a moment look to see the blind and bloody soldier with foul hand defile the locks of your shrill-shrieking daughters, your fathers taken by the silver beards and their most reverent heads dashed to the walls, your naked infants spittered upon pikes." In King Lear, the Duke of Cornwall gouges out the eyes of the Earl of Gloucester. Out, vile jelly! Whereupon his wife Regan orders the Earl, bleeding from the sockets, out of the house. Go, thrust him out at gates, and let him smell his way to Dover. In The Merchant of Venice, Shylock obtains the right to cut a pound of flesh from the chest of the guarantor of a loan. In Titus Andronicus, two men kill another man, rape his bride, cut out her tongue, and amputate her hands. Her father kills the rapists, cooks them in a pie, and feeds them to their mother, whom he then kills before killing his own daughter for having gotten raped in the first place. Then he is killed, and his killer is killed. Entertainment written for children was no less grisly. In 1815, Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm published a compendium of old folk tales that had gradually been adapted for children. Commonly known as Grimm's Fairy Tales, the collection ranks with the Bible and Shakespeare as one of the best-selling and most respected works in the Western canon. Though it isn't obvious from the Baudelaireized versions in Walt Disney films, the tales are filled with murder, infanticide, cannibalism, mutilation, and sexual abuse. Grim fairy tales, indeed. Take just the three famous stepmother stories. During a famine, the father and stepmother of Hansel and Gretel abandon them in a forest so that they will starve to death. The children stumble upon an edible house inhabited by a witch who imprisons Hansel and fattens him up in preparation for eating him. Fortunately, Gretel shoves the witch into a fiery oven and the godless witch burned to death in a horrible way. Cinderella's stepsisters, when trying to squeeze into her slippers, take their mother's advice and cut off a toe or heel to make them fit. Doves notice the blood, and after Cinderella marries the prince, they peck out the stepsisters' eyes, punishing them for their wickedness and malice with blindness for the rest of their lives. Snow White arouses the jealousy of her stepmother, the queen, so the queen orders a hunter to take her into the forest, kill her, and bring back her lungs and liver for the queen to eat. When the queen realizes that Snow White has escaped, she makes three more attempts on her life, two by poison, one by asphyxiation. After the prince has revived her, the queen crashes their wedding, but iron slippers had already been heated up for her over a fire of coals. She had to put on the red-hot iron shoes and dance in them until she dropped to the ground, dead. As we shall see, purveyors of entertainment for young children today have become so intolerant of violence that even episodes of the early Muppets have been deemed too dangerous for them. And speaking of puppetry, one of the most popular forms of children's entertainment in Europe used to be the Punch and Judy show. Well into the 20th century, this pair of bickering glove puppets acted out slapstick routines in ornate booths in English seaside towns. The literature scholar Harold Schechter summarizes a typical plot. It begins when Punch goes to pet his neighbor's dog, which promptly clamps its teeth around the puppet's grotesquely oversized nose. After prying the dog loose, Punch summons the owner, Scaramouche, and, after a bit of crude banter, knocks the fellow's head clean off his shoulders. Punch then calls for his wife, Judy, and requests a kiss. She responds by walloping him in the face. Seeking another outlet for his affection, Punch asks for his infant child and begins to cradle it. Unfortunately, the baby picks that moment to dirty itself. Always the loving family man, Punch reacts by beating the baby's head against the stage, then hurling its dead body into the audience. When Judy reappears and discovers what's happened, she is understandably upset. Tearing Punch's stick from his hands, she begins to lay into him. He wrestles the cudgel away from her, pummels her to death, and then breaks into a triumphant little song. Who'd be plagued with a wife that could set himself free with a rope or a knife or a good stick like me? Even Mother Goose nursery rhymes, which mostly date from the 17th and 18th centuries, are jarring by the standards of what we let small children hear today. Cock Robin is murdered in cold blood. A single mother living in substandard housing has numerous illegitimate children and abuses them with whipping and starvation. Two unsupervised children are allowed to go on a dangerous errand. Jack sustains a head injury that could leave him with brain damage, while Jill's condition is unknown. A drifter confesses that he threw an old man down the stairs. Georgie Porgy sexually harasses underage girls, leaving them with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Humpty Dumpty remains in critical condition after a crippling accident. A negligent mother leaves a baby unattended on a treetop with disastrous results. A blackbird swoops down on a domestic employee hanging up laundry and maliciously wounds her nose. Three vision-impaired mice are mutilated with a carving knife. And here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head. A recent article in the Archives of Diseases of Childhood measured the rates of violence in different genres of children's entertainment. The television programs had 4.8 violent scenes per hour. The nursery rhymes had 52.2. Honor in Europe and the early United States. If you have an American $10 bill handy, look at the man portrayed on it and give a moment's thought to his life and death. Alexander Hamilton is one of American history's most luminous figures. As a co-author of the Federalist Papers, he helped to articulate the philosophical basis of democracy. As America's first Secretary of the Treasury, he devised the institutions that support modern market economies. At other times in his life, he led three battalions in the Revolutionary War, helped launch the Constitutional Convention, commanded a national army, established the Bank of New York, served in the New York legislature, and founded the New York Post. Yet in 1804, this brilliant man did something that by today's standards was astonishingly stupid. Hamilton had long exchanged bitchy remarks with his rival, Vice President Aaron Burr, and when Hamilton refused to disavow a criticism of Burr that had been attributed to him, Burr challenged him to a duel. Common sense was just one of many forces that could have pulled him away from a date with death. The custom of dueling was already on the wane, and Hamilton's state of residence, New York, had outlawed it. Hamilton had lost a son to a duel, and in a letter explaining his response to Burr's challenge, he enumerated five objections to the practice. But he agreed to the duel anyway, because, he wrote, what men of the world denominate honor left him no other choice. The following morning, he was rowed across the Hudson to face Burr on the New Jersey Palisades. Burr would not be the last vice president to shoot a man, but he was a better shot than Dick Cheney, and Hamilton died the following day. Nor was Hamilton the only American statesman to be drawn into a duel. Henry Clay fought in one, and James Monroe thought the better of challenging John Adams only because Adams was president at the time. Among the other faces on American currency, Andrew Jackson, immortalized on the $20 bill, carried bullets from so many duels that he claimed to rattle like a bag of marbles when he walked. Even the great emancipator on the $5 bill, Abraham Lincoln, accepted a challenge to fight a duel, though he set the conditions to ensure that it would not be consummated. Formal dueling was not, of course, an American invention. It emerged during the Renaissance as a measure to curtail assassinations, vendettas, and street brawls among aristocrats and their retinues. When one man felt that his honor had been impugned, he could challenge the other to a duel and cap the violence at a single death, with no hard feelings among the defeated man's clan or entourage. But as the essayist Arthur Crystal observes, the gentry took honor so seriously that just about every offense became an offense against honor. Two Englishmen dueled because their dogs had fought. Two Italian gentlemen fell out over the respective merits of Tasso and Ariosto, an argument that ended when one combatant, mortally wounded, admitted that he had not read the poet he was championing. And Byron's great uncle William, the fifth Baron Byron, killed a man after disagreeing about whose property furnished more game. Dueling persisted in the 18th and 19th centuries, despite denunciations by the church and prohibitions by many governments. Samuel Johnson defended the custom, writing, "A man may shoot the man who invades his character, as he may shoot him who attempts to break into his house." Duelling sucked in such luminaries as Voltaire, Napoleon, the Duke of Wellington, Robert Peel, Tolstoy, Pushkin, and the mathematician Évariste Galois, the last two fatally. The build-up, climax, and denouement of a duel were made to order for fiction writers, and the dramatic possibilities were put to use by Sir Walter Scott, Dumas père, de Maupassant, Conrad, Tolstoy, Pushkin, Chekhov, and Thomas Mann. The career of dueling showcases a puzzling phenomenon we will often encounter. A category of violence can be embedded in a civilization for centuries and then vanish into thin air. When gentlemen agreed to a duel, they were fighting not for money or land or even women, but for honor, the strange commodity that exists because everyone believes that everyone else believes that it exists. Honor is a bubble that can be inflated by some parts of human nature, such as the drive for prestige and the entrenchment of norms, and popped by others, such as a sense of humor. The institution of formal dueling petered out in the English-speaking world by the middle of the 19th century, and in the rest of Europe in the following decades. Historians have noted that the institution was buried not so much by legal bans or moral disapproval, as by ridicule. When solemn gentlemen went to the field of honor only to be laughed at by the younger generation, that was more than any custom, no matter how sanctified by tradition, could endure. Today the expression, "take 10 paces, turn and fire," is more likely to call to mind Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam than men of honor. The 20th century. As our tour of the history of forgotten violence comes within sight of the present, the landmarks start to look more familiar. But even the zone of cultural memory from the last century has relics that feel like they belong to a foreign country. Take the decline of martial culture. The older cities in Europe and the United States are dotted with public works that flaunt the nation's military might. Pedestrians can behold statues of commanders on horseback, beefcake sculptures of well-hung Greek warriors, victory arches crowned by chariots, and iron fencing wrought into the shape of swords and spears. Subway stops are named for triumphant battles. The Paris Metro has an Austerlitz station. The London Underground has a Waterloo station. Photos from a century ago show men in gaudy military dress uniforms parading on national holidays and hobnobbing with aristocrats at fancy dinners. The visual branding of long-established states is heavy on aggressive iconography such as projectiles, edged weapons, birds of prey, and predatory cats. Even famously pacifistic Massachusetts has a seal that features an amputated arm brandishing a sword and a Native American holding a bow and arrow above the state motto, "With the sword we seek peace, but under liberty." Not to be outdone, neighboring New Hampshire adorns its license plates with the motto, "Live free or die." But in the West today, public places are no longer named after military victories. Our war memorials depict not proud commanders on horseback, but weeping mothers, weary soldiers, or exhaustive lists of names of the dead. Military men are inconspicuous in public life, with drab uniforms and little prestige among the hoi polloi. In London's Trafalgar Square, the plinth across from the Big Lions and Nelson's Column was recently topped with a sculpture that is about as far from military iconography as one can imagine, a nude, pregnant artist who had been born without arms and legs. The World War I battlefield in Ypres, Belgium, inspiration for the poem Flanders Fields, and the poppies worn in Commonwealth countries on November 11th, has just sprouted a memorial to the 1,000 soldiers who were shot in that war for desertion, men who at the time were despised as contemptible cowards. And the two most recent American state mottos are Alaska's "North to the Future" and Hawaii's "The Life of the Land is Perpetuated in Righteousness." Though when Wisconsin solicited a replacement for America's Dairyland, one of the entries was, "Eat cheese or die." Conspicuous pacifism is especially striking in Germany, a nation that was once so connected to martial values that the words Teutonic and Prussian became synonyms for rigid militarism. As recently as 1964, the satirist Tom Lehrer expressed a common fear at the prospect of West Germany participating in a multilateral nuclear coalition. In a sarcastic lullaby, the singer reassures a baby, "Once all the Germans were warlike and mean, but that couldn't happen again. We taught them a lesson in 1918, and they've hardly bothered us since then." The fear of a revanchist Germany was revived in 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, and the two Germanys made plans to reunite. Yet today, German culture remains racked with soul-searching over its role in the world wars and permeated with revulsion against anything that smacks of military force. Violence is taboo even in video games, and when Parker Brothers tried to introduce a German version of Risk, the board game in which players try to dominate a map of the world, the German government tried to censor it. Eventually, the rules were rewritten so that players were liberating rather than conquering their opponents' territories. German pacifism is not just symbolic. In 2003, 500,000 Germans marched to oppose the American-led invasion of Iraq. The American Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, famously wrote the country off as part of Old Europe. Given the history of ceaseless war on that continent, the remark may have been the most flagrant display of historical amnesia since the student who complained about the clichés in Shakespeare. Many of us have lived through another change in Western sensibilities toward military symbolism. When the ultimate military weapons, nuclear bombs, were unveiled in the 1940s and 1950s, people were not repelled, even though the weapons had recently snuffed out 250,000 lives and were threatening to annihilate hundreds of millions more. No, the world found them charming. A sexy bathing suit, the bikini, was named after a Micronesian atoll that had been vaporized by nuclear tests because the designer compared the onlooker's reaction to an atomic blast. Ludicrous civil defense measures like backyard fallout shelters and duck-and-cover classroom drills encouraged the delusion that a nuclear attack would be no big deal. To this day, triple-triangle fallout shelter signs rust above the basement entrances of many American apartment buildings and schools. Many commercial logos from the 1950s featured mushroom clouds, including Atomic Fireball Jawbreaker candies, the Atomic Market, a mom-and-pop grocery store not far from MIT, and the Atomic Cafe, which lent its name to a 1982 documentary on the bizarre nonchalance with which the world treated nuclear weapons through the early 1960s, when horror finally began to sink in. Another major change we have lived through is an intolerance of displays of force in everyday life. In earlier decades, a man's willingness to use his fist in response to an insult was the sign of respectability. Today, it is the sign of a boor, a symptom of impulse control disorder, a ticket to anger management therapy. An incident from 1950 illustrates the change. President Harry Truman had seen an unkind review in the Washington Post of a performance by his daughter, Margaret, an aspiring singer. Truman wrote to the critic on White House stationery, "Someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below." Though every writer can sympathize with the impulse, today a public threat to commit aggravated assault against a critic would seem buffoonish, indeed sinister, if it came from a person in power. But at the time, Truman was widely admired for his paternal chivalry. And if you recognize the expressions 97-pound weakling and get sand kicked in your face, you are probably familiar with the iconic ads for the Charles Atlas bodybuilding program, which ran in magazines and comic books starting in the 1940s. In the typical storyline, an ectomorph is assaulted on the beach in front of his girlfriend. He skulks home, kicks a chair, gambles a 10-cent stamp, receives instructions for an exercise program, and returns to the beach to wreak revenge on his assailant, restoring his standing with the beaming young woman. When it came to the product, Atlas was ahead of his time. The popularity of bodybuilding soared in the 1980s. But when it came to marketing, he belonged to a different era. Today, the ads for gyms and exercise paraphernalia don't feature the use of fisticuffs to restore manly honor. The image is narcissistic, almost homoerotic. Bulging pectorals and rippling abdominals are shown in arty close-up for both sexes to admire. The advantage they promise is in beauty, not might. Even more revolutionary than the scorn for violence between men is the scorn for violence against women. Many baby boomers are nostalgic for The Honeymooners, a 1950s sitcom featuring Jackie Gleason as a burly bus driver whose get-rich-quick schemes are ridiculed by his sensible wife, Alice. In one of the show's recurring laugh lines, an enraged Ralph shakes his fist at her and bellows, "One of these days, Alice! One of these days!" Pow! Right in the kisser. Or sometimes, bang, zoom, straight to the moon. Alice always laughs it off, not because she has contempt for a wife-beater, but because she knows that Ralph is not man enough to do it. Nowadays, our sensitivity to violence against women makes this kind of comedy in a mainstream television program unthinkable. Or consider the Life magazine ad from 1952, in which a young husband is shown spanking his wife because she hasn't taken steps to bring home the freshest coffee from the grocery store. Today, this ad's playful, eroticized treatment of domestic violence would put it beyond the pale of the printable. It was by no means unique. A wife is also spanked in a 1950s ad for Van Heusen shirts, and a 1953 ad for Pitney Bowes postage meters shows an exasperated boss screaming at a stubborn secretary with the caption, "Is it always illegal to kill a woman?" And then there's the longest-running musical, The Fantastics, with its Gilbert and Sullivan-like ditty, "It Depends on What You Pay," whose lyrics were based on a 1905 translation of Edmond Rostand's play, Les Romanesques. Two men plot a kidnapping in which the son of one will rescue the daughter of the other. "You can get the rape emphatic, you can get the rape polite, you can get the rape with Indians, a very charming sight. You can get the rape on horseback, they all say it's new and gay. So you see, the sort of rape depends on what you pay." Though the word rape referred to abduction rather than sexual assault between the opening of the play in 1960 and the end of its run in 2002, sensibilities about rape changed. As the librettist Tom Jones, no relation to the Welsh singer, explained to me, "As time went on, I began to feel anxious about the word. Slowly, ever so slowly, things began to register on me. Headlines in the papers, accounts of brutal gang rapes, and of date rapes, too. I began to think, this isn't funny. True, we weren't talking about real rape, but there is no doubt that part of the laughter came from the shock value of using the word in this comic manner." In the early 1970s, the producer of the play refused Jones's request to rewrite the lyrics, but allowed him to add an introduction to the song, explaining the intended meaning of the word and to reduce the number of repetitions of it. After the play closed in 2002, Jones rewrote the lyrics from scratch for a 2006 restaging, and he has legally ensured that only the new version may be performed in any production of The Fantastics anywhere in the world. Until recently, children too were legitimate targets of violence. Parents not only spanked their children, a punishment that today has been outlawed in many countries, but commonly used a weapon like a hairbrush or paddle, or exposed the child's buttocks to increase the pain and humiliation. In a sequence that was common in children's stories through the 1950s, a mother warned a naughty child, "Wait till your father gets home," whereupon the stronger parent would remove his belt and use it to flog the child. Other commonly depicted ways of punishing children with physical pain included sending them to bed without dinner and washing their mouths out with soap. Children who were left to the mercy of unrelated adults were treated even more brutally. Within recent memory, many school children were disciplined in ways that today would be classified as torture and that would put their teachers in jail. People today think of the world as a uniquely dangerous place. It's hard to follow the news without a mounting dread of terrorist attacks, a clash of civilizations, and the use of weapons of mass destruction. But we are apt to forget the dangers that filled the news a few decades ago, and to be blasé about the good fortune that so many of them have fizzled out. In later chapters, I will present numbers that show that the 1960s and 1970s were a vastly more brutal and menacing time than the one in which we live. But for now, in keeping with the spirit of this chapter, I will make the case impressionistically. I graduated from university in 1976. Like most college alumni, I have no memory of the commencement speech that sent me into the world of adulthood. This gives me license to invent one today. Imagine the following forecast from an expert on the state of the world in the mid-1970s. Mr. Principal, members of the faculty, family, friends, and class of 1976. Now is a time of great challenges, but it is also a time of great opportunities. As you embark on your lives as educated men and women, I call on you to give something back to your community, to work for a brighter future, and to try to make the world a better place. Now that we have that out of the way, I have something more interesting to say to you. I want to share my vision of what the world will be like at the time of your 35th reunion. The calendar will have rolled over into a new millennium, bringing you a world that is beyond your imagination. I am not referring to the advance of technology, though it will have effects you can barely conceive. I am referring to the advance of peace and human security, which you will find even harder to conceive. To be sure, the world of 2011 will still be a dangerous place. During the next 35 years, there will be wars as there are today, and there will be genocides as there are today, some of them in places no one would have predicted. Nuclear weapons will still be a threat. Some of the violent regions of the world will continue to be violent. But superimposed on these constants will be unfathomable changes. First and foremost, the nightmare that has darkened your lives since your early memories of cowering in fallout shelters, a nuclear doomsday and a third world war, will come to an end. In a decade, the Soviet Union will declare peace with the West, and the Cold War will be over without a shot being fired. China will also fall off the radar as a military threat. Indeed, it will become our major trading partner. During the next 35 years, no nuclear weapon will be used against an enemy. In fact, there will be no wars between major nations at all. The peace in Western Europe will continue indefinitely. And within 5 years, the incessant warring in East Asia will give way to a long peace there as well. There is more good news. East Germany will open its border, and joyful students will sledgehammer the Berlin Wall to smithereens. The Iron Curtain will vanish, and the nations of Central and Eastern Europe will become liberal democracies free of Soviet domination. The Soviet Union will not only abandon totalitarian communism, but will voluntarily go out of existence. The republics that Russia has occupied for decades and centuries will become independent states, many of them democratic. In most of the countries, this will happen with not a drop of blood being spilled. Fascism, too, will vanish from Europe, then from much of the rest of the world. Portugal, Spain, and Greece will become liberal democracies. So will Taiwan, South Korea, and most of South and Central America. The generalissimos, the colonels, the juntas, the banana republics, and the annual military coups will depart the stage in most of the developed world. The Middle East also has surprises in store. You have just lived through the fifth war between Israel and Arab states in 25 years. These wars have killed 50,000 people and recently threatened to drag the superpowers into a nuclear confrontation. But within 3 years, the president of Egypt will hug the prime minister of Israel in the Knesset, and they will sign a peace treaty that will last into the indefinite future. Jordan, too, will make a lasting peace with Israel. Syria will engage in sporadic peace talks with Israel, and the two countries will not go to war. In South Africa, the apartheid regime will be dismantled, and the white minority will cede power to the black majority. This will happen with no civil war, no bloodbath, no violent recriminations against the former oppressors. Many of these developments will be the result of long and courageous struggles. But some of them will just happen, catching everyone by surprise. Perhaps some of you will try to figure out how it all happened. I congratulate you on your accomplishments and wish you success and satisfaction in the years ahead. How would the audience have reacted to this outburst of optimism? Those who were listening would have broken out in snickers and shared a suspicion that the speaker was still tripping on the brown acid from Woodstock. Yet in every case, the optimist would have been right. No sightseer can understand a country from a city-a-day tour, and I don't expect this skitter across the centuries to have convinced you that the past was more violent than the present. Now that you're back home, you are surely filled with questions. Don't we still torture people? Wasn't the 20th century the bloodiest in history? Haven't new forms of war replaced the old ones? Aren't we living in the age of terror? Didn't they say that war was obsolete in 1910? What about all the chickens in factory farms? And couldn't nuclear terrorists start a major war tomorrow? These are excellent questions, and I will try to answer them in the rest of the book with the help of historical studies and quantitative data sets. But I hope that these sanity checks have prepared the ground. They remind us that for all the dangers we face today, the dangers of yesterday were even worse. Listeners to this book, and as we shall see, people in most of the rest of the world, no longer have to worry about abduction into sexual slavery, divinely committed genocide, lethal circuses and tournaments, punishment on the cross, rack, wheel, stake, or strapado for holding unpopular beliefs, decapitation for not bearing a son, disembowelment for having dated a royal, pistol duels to defend their honor, beachside fisticuffs to impress their girlfriends, and the prospect of a nuclear world war that would put an end to civilization or to human life itself. Chapter 2. The Pacification Process. Look, life is nasty, brutish, and short. But you knew that when you became a caveman. New Yorker cartoon. Thomas Hobbes and Charles Darwin were nice men whose names became nasty adjectives. No one wants to live in a world that is Hobbesian or Darwinian, not to mention Malthusian, Machiavellian, or Orwellian. The two men were immortalized in the lexicon for their cynical synopses of life in a state of nature. Darwin for survival of the fittest, a phrase he used but did not coin. Hobbes for the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Yet both men gave us insights about violence that are deeper, subtler, and ultimately more humane than their eponymous adjectives imply. Today, any understanding of human violence must begin with their analyses. This chapter is about the origins of violence, in both the logical and the chronological sense. With the help of Darwin and Hobbes, we will look at the adaptive logic of violence and its predictions for the kinds of violent impulses that might have evolved as a part of human nature. We will then turn to the prehistory of violence, examining when violence appeared in our evolutionary lineage, how common it was in the millennia before history was written down, and what kinds of historical developments first reduced it. The logic of violence. Darwin gave us a theory of why living things have the traits they have, not just their bodily traits, but the basic mindsets and motives that drive their behavior. 150 years after The Origin of Species was published, the theory of natural selection has been amply verified in the lab and field, and has been augmented with ideas from new fields of science and mathematics to yield